You're listening to Inanna Joy's Sonic Garden on rockinhotradio.com. And now, Nocturne.
Fountain of Youth.
By the time they reached their early 60s, Everett and Celestine had perfected the art of being divorced. Not bitterly divorced, but not gracefully either. They occupied the strange middle country between resentment and devotion, a place with no legal name and no Hallmark card. They lived 12 minutes apart. Everett still changed the oil in Celestine's car, although he complained about the way she ignored every warning light until the dashboard glowed like Christmas. Celestine still called Everett whenever the supermarket marked down whole chickens or put his favorite salt pork on sale. When Everett's older brother Louis died, Celestine sat beside him at the funeral and kept refilling his paper cup with water because grief made his hands tremble. When Celestine needed a biopsy, Everett drove her to the hospital, waited through the procedure, and bought her soup afterward, without making a spectacle of his concern. They loaned each other grocery money and traded cold medicine, neighborhood gossip and warnings about potholes. They knew what relatives the other avoided and which lies the other told when frightened. Sometimes, one of them would call simply to ask a question.
You remember the name of that Jamaican spot near the old theater? Want me some oxtails?
Did your mama take my blue vase out the house? I ain't seen that since your ass left.
Any question could be answered in 3 minutes, yet somehow they would remain on the phone for 45. Neither admitted enjoying it. They had no children, which meant there had never been any custody schedule, no graduations or grandbabies forcing them into the same room. Nothing required them to remain in one another's lives. They simply did. Their marriage had lasted 17 years. Their divorce had lasted 21. They had now been unmarried longer than they had been husband and wife. Yet strangers still occasionally mistook them for a couple. Celestine always corrected them. Everett usually didn't. One evening, Celestine called him about her bathroom sink.
It's banging and clanging again, she said.
Sinks don't make noises, Sal.
What this one do?
He could tell she was already a little tipsy, even though the night was still young.
What kind of noise?
A clog noise. Sound like some kind of vermin got stuck in there or something. I don't know. You coming or not?
I'll be over there in a little bit, Sal. The game on.
What kind of game?
The football game, Sal.
Who playing? It's still football season?
I'm going to be over there later, Sal. Get off the damn phone.
Well, bring me $50 when you coming. I don't want it on no card.
God damn it, I ain't got nothing for you, Sal. Just gave you $20 for gas.
Johnny told me you hit the numbers and bought some food stamps.
I ain't bought but 50. Why are you telling you my business, Sal?
Before he could even finish saying her name, she hung up.
Now, ain't that some shit?
He said, right before checking his wallet to find out if he really did have some extra cash. He arrived an hour later, carrying a toolbox and the expression of a man personally offended by plumbing. Celestine's bathroom was crowded with perfume bottles, hair products, lotions, and several shopping bags from the cosmetics counter at Macy's. New lipsticks and foundation compacts covered the sink. Everett stared at them.
What happened here?
Nothing.
You rob a beauty supply store?
I bought a few things.
A few? Got enough war paint in here to invade Iraq again. That's the shit that's clogging this sink.
Celestine folded her arms. She was wearing a fitted leopard print jumpsuit with gold hoop earrings large enough to catch radio waves. The outfit looked like something she might have worn in 1986, although her body now carried the honest evidence of time. Softened arms, a generous waist, swollen knees that stiffened her gait considerably, and the small forward lean she developed whenever her back ached. She still moved with drama, if not quite with ease. Everett picked up a lipstick and read the label.
Seductive plum.
Put that down and tend to this sink.
You think this gonna do your old ass some good?
Celestine snatched it from him.
My old ass still look better than half the women you try to talk to.
I ain't trying to talk to nobody.
That's 'cause don't nobody want to hear what you got to say.
Everett laughed and knelt beneath the sink. Celestine leaned against the doorway.
I'm going to find me a nice young man and we're going to live on cruise ships.
Everett jumped back up.
A younger man for what? A nursing aide?
She sucked her teeth and turned to walk away.
To drive you to physical therapy, Miss Daisy?
She ran back in and kicked his shoe. Everett chuckled.
Better make sure he can lift you out the bathtub.
I still got it.
You got arthritis.
I got options. I'm gonna give me somebody to give me a massage and run me a bubble bath and change your diapers.
Now that irritated Celestine.
See, that's your problem. Ain't nothing wrong with wanting something. I want to travel and get flued out. Why you ain't never fly me nowhere?
You right, sir. Ain't nothing wrong with it. But you got to be the dumbest dunce that ever was if you think a young man gonna fly you anywhere but over the cuckoo's nest.
Something negative about
everything. Keep trying to tell you, set your ass down. Go rest yourself. You earned
it. That's why I don't even want you in my business.
Celestine tuned him out and walked to the kitchen. She still believed love could arrive, and with trumpets. Not companionship, not tenderness that grew slowly through shared errands and repaired sinks. She wanted the grand thing, the sweeping thing. A man who would see her across a crowded room and recognize that the universe had spent 63 years preparing them for one another. She had wanted the same thing at 28, and she still didn't know any better. In those days, he had tried to become it for her, and several other women. She had tried to become whatever would make him want to be it for only her. They both failed. The following Saturday, they fried fish at Everett's house. It was something they did during the marriage and occasionally continued after it ended. Celestine brought whiting, hot sauce, and a bag of cornmeal. Everett supplied beer and the labor. They ate in front of the TV while an old soul playlist drifted from a speaker. Celestine told the story of the time Everett fell asleep at his cousin's wedding and snored through the vows.
Stop lying, Sal.
Your own auntie had to wake your loud tail up. I was working nights. Slept through their entire marriage.
Turned out I didn't miss much. They got divorced before we did.
Celestine lifted her beer.
To two stubborn fools.
The television flickered. Everett reached for the remote. The image dissolved into gray static. Celestine said,
"That's weird. These new TVs ain't supposed to do that."
The static deepened, filling the screen with restless white snow. Beneath it came a faint humming, followed by the distant sound of laughter. Then a woman appeared. She stood before a fountain surrounded by blue flowers. Her silver hair fell to her waist, yet her face was smooth and luminous. She wore a white gown that moved as if underwater. Have you loved too late? She asked.
Everett lowered his beer.
Have you surrendered your best years to disappointment? Do you daydream of returning to the beginning, not merely younger, but wiser?
A golden bottle rose from the fountain.
Try Revita Eternal Tonic. Reclaim the years regret stole from you. Restore vitality. Correct the past. Become who you were meant to be. A telephone number flashed across the screen. There was no website, no price, no list of side effects. Celestine grabbed her phone.
You can't be serious,
Everett said.
What harm can it do? That's the question people ask right before losing money. Write down the number. You write it down.
I am.
She purchased two bottles. They arrived 3 days later in a wooden box with no return address. Inside, the tonic glowed faintly gold. The instructions consisted of a single line. Drink together. Name the moment you wish to relive. What binds you will return with you.
That sounds like demons,
Everett said.
You always so negative.
That sentence was engraved in wood like them witches do out in the forest.
Celestine poured two small glasses, and despite all his trash talking, Everett agreed to take it right along with her. They decided to return to the spring of 1987, 6 months before their wedding. They agreed they would correct the mistakes they now understood. They touched glasses.
To doing it right.
Yeah, Everett replied.
To not doing it stupid.
The tonic tasted like honey, rainwater, and something metallic. The room stretched. Everett felt every bone in his body loosen, then pull backward through itself. The television collapsed into a single bright point. When the world returned, he was standing in Celestine's old apartment. His hands were young, his belly was flat. Celestine stood before him in a silk robe, her face smooth, her eyes enormous. For several seconds, they merely stared. Then Celestine screamed with delight. They married again. This time, Everett promised to communicate better, to consider her concerns as important as his own. Celestine promised not to expect perfection. They read relationship books, divided the housework, and scheduled Sunday conversations about their feelings. For a while, it worked. Then the old architecture reassembled itself around them. Celestine's mother asked when she planned to become a proper wife. Everett's friends mocked him for asking permission before making plans. The church advised Celestine to respect Everett's leadership. Everett was told that a man unable to control his home could not expect respect outside of it. Their careful conversations became negotiations over authority. Who decided where they lived? Whose career mattered more? Who owed whom sex, sacrifice, silence, and gratitude? By the sixth year, they were arguing over the same things in more sophisticated language. By the ninth, Celestine sat in divorce court wearing a new red suit she had known the first time. The judge's gavel fell. The courtroom vanished, and they returned to Everett's living room. 60-something again, their fish gone cold. Celestine stared at him.
I think we chose the wrong year.
Everett rubbed his face.
You think that's it?
We went back too far down the road. We got to go back to the beginning.
They agreed. The second journey took them to the night they met. This time, Celestine decided not to appear too eager. Everett decided not to pretend he wanted children simply because he thought women wanted it. They courted more honestly. They discussed money, fidelity, household labor, sex, ambition, religion, and family obligations before marriage. They wrote their own vows. Celestine kept her maiden name. Everett learned to cook more than eggs. Yet marriage still altered the air around them. Friends stopped inviting Celestine on trips unless Everett was included. Everett's family began calling Celestine whenever Everett forgot a birthday, as though she had been appointed keeper of his kinship. Employers assumed Everett could work late because his wife would manage the household. Supervisors figured Celestine was less committed and more of a risk, therefore giving her less opportunity because she might eventually prioritize family. Their private arrangement was slowly colonized by public expectation. They resisted. Then they resented having to resist. Eventually, every disagreement carried the accumulated weight of what husbands and wives are supposed to be. This marriage lasted 14 years. It also ended in court. When they returned, the wooden box sat open between them. Only enough tonic remained for one final journey. Celestine's eyes were wet.
What if we go back and never meet?
Everett looked at her. The thought hurt more than he expected.
No, he said. I don't want that. Then what do we change?
He didn't have an answer. That night, Everett dreamed of the silver-haired woman from the commercial. She stood beside the fountain, trailing her fingers through glowing water. You keep trying to repair the cage, she said. Everett approached her.
What cage?
The one you mistook for shelter.
But Celestine and I, we loved each other.
Yes, she agreed.
We still do, in a way.
Of course you do.
Then why can't we make this work?
The woman smiled sadly. You did make it work. You carried one another through sickness, grief, hunger, disappointment, and age. You remained, even when the contract ended. Yet you call the marriage the success and the enduring friendship a failure. Everett looked into the fountain. Inside it, he saw every version of himself and Celestine standing before ministers, judges, relatives, and clerks. In every life, they entered marriage as two people and gradually became roles. Husband, wife, provider, helpmeet, leader, dependent, possession, proof.
What does this tonic really do?
He asked. It returns vitality to those willing to stop surrendering it.
What happens if we drink it again?
You will receive the life your choice can sustain.
And if we marry?
You already know. Everett awakened before dawn. Celestine was asleep on his sofa, one hand curled beneath her cheek. He studied the woman who had known him in more versions of his life than anyone else ever would. In the morning, he told her about the dream. She listened quietly.
So you think marriage itself is a problem?
She said.
I think trying to force what we got into marriage is the problem. What we have is not romantic. It has been sometimes,
Celestine looked away. Everett continued,
"Maybe love don't have to become the ownership to be real. Maybe staying in separate houses like we do, helping each other and enjoying each other's company when we want to, is not some lesser thing."
Celestine wasn't sure.
Love is supposed to be more than that. More of what?
What Celestine had always wanted was the story, the proof. Not merely someone who showed up, but someone whose presence proved something, that she had been chosen, that she had not aged beyond desire, that her life had arrived at the ending promised to her when she was young. Because she had earned it, and all the fanfare proved that she was worthy of it. Everett poured the remaining tonic into two glasses.
"I'm not going to marry you again," he said. "Not in any year."
Celestine's mouth tightened.
"Then maybe you don't deserve another chance."
"Maybe another chance is choosing different."
She pushed her glass away. Everett drank his. The liquid burned through him like sunlight. For one instant, he saw Celestine at every age, laughing at 29, furious at 42, frightened beside her mother's hospital bed at 56, proud in leopard print at 63. Then the vision closed. Over the following months, Everett changed. His pain diminished. His hair darkened a little at the temples. His skin regained some warmth. He did not become 25, nor did he want to. He became intensely alive. He traveled. He learned to swim. He dated a widowed jazz singer who lived three states away and a retired science teacher who refused exclusivity. Everyone involved knew the truth. No one was promised ownership. He and Celestine remained friends. He still repaired her car. She still called about coffee sales. Sometimes she teased him about his lovers, and he teased her about the photographs she posted on dating apps, carefully angled, heavily filtered, accompanied by declarations that she sought a chivalrous man who knew how to treat a queen. She kept searching for the fairy tale. Her knees worsened. Diabetes made her tired. Still, she refused to drink what remained in that glass. She kept it sealed in a perfume bottle beside the seductive plum lipstick, waiting for a man worthy of sharing it. Everett lived another 30 years without becoming old in spirit. One autumn evening, after dinner with two people he loved in different ways, he lay down beneath an open window. Night air moved across his face. He heard the faint sound of water. The silver-haired woman stood in the corner.
"Was I right?"
he asked. "You were free," she replied.
"That ain't the same thing."
"No," she said. "It's better." Everett smiled. His death was gentle and immediate, like a lamp being switched off after a beautiful party. At his funeral, Celestine sat on the front row. She was 92, wrapped in gold fabric, her hands swollen with age. In her purse, beside her medication and her phone filled with unanswered messages, she carried the final dose of tonic. That night, she returned home alone. The TV flickered. Static filled the room. The fountain appeared again. The silver-haired woman looked directly at her. "Have you loved too late?" she asked. I'm Inanna Joy. Thank you for spending this time with me here in Inanna Joy's Sonic Garden. Be sure to pick up my award-winning book, Fuck Submission. Ending the Gender Wars for Good, available now on Amazon. To learn more about me and read my blog, check out www.inanna-joy.com. That's www.inanna-joy.com. Until next time, follow your bliss to your purpose, align with your joy, and live well. I'll meet you again soon in Inanna Joy's Sonic Garden.
Time's been moving slowly, so we are already in.